I'm Dana Lombardi. Thank you so much for coming to the War College. As you can tell, we did a little bit of upscale signage here this year at Celesticon, our second year. We have some very good speakers. We just heard Leland Erickson about 1940, the myths of the French campaign. And Jack Green, a good friend of mine, a game designer, as well as a nonfiction book author, has also done a book on the 1940 campaign. But this one's about the invasion of Norway and Denmark. And so it's very complementary to what Leland was talking about. Jack's got some interesting viewpoints on it. You may think, what could be done after all these years? Haven't there been lots of books on this subject, including the official British history, et cetera, et cetera? Jack has some fabulous information because he went into the Norwegian archives, which, I know, as strange as it sounds, guess what? A lot of people don't even bother. They'll go to the German, they'll go to the British. Sometimes they might even do the French for the forces that were there. But I don't even recall anyone that did the kind of depth that you did, Jack, on the Norwegian archives and what information you were able to pull out. Is that correct?
Fair enough.
Okay.
There's a Geir Haar, who's done two volumes on the invasion of Norway, the naval side, and they're excellent. And they're much more in-depth than our book.
Okay. Well, then, I'll tell you what, since you're going to go ahead and start,
sure.
I'll let you go ahead and do it. I'm going to run upstairs and grab my PowerPoint. I'll be right back. But please, Jack, welcome Jack.
So I'm going to open with the title of the book. In contacting the British publisher, they said the best thing that you could do to publish a book, a history book, that would end up helping sales, is if you could have in the title, Hitler, dog, Nazi, and sex. Okay, we're two of four. We got the Nazi invasion, which was actually my pandering to the publisher. I said, yeah, we'll put that in. But it also means the ideal book title will be Hitler's Nazi Dog Blondie's Sex Life. Which actually sounds like a good thing for a country.
You forgot our rain.
Pardon?
You forgot our rain.
I'm going to kind of ramble and talk about some of the things that we have in the book that I think that you guys will find of interest. We did manage to do a lot of research on the Danes as well as the Norwegians. In fact, there's one book by McIntyre, Captain McIntyre, called Narvik, which is a history of the naval fighting. Came out in the 60s, I think. The invasion of Denmark, he has two footnotes, and they're both one sentence long. We devote a whole chapter. And it's only they were talking about the five-day war for the Netherlands in the last lecture. Well, the Danes fought for 3 hours, and then they surrendered. Basically, what the Nazis came up with is that they were concerned that Norway might go end up being captured by the Allies. So what they ended up doing is they figured that they could, if they could get everybody to arrive on Tuesday at 4:15 in the morning from Narvik all the way down to Oslo, as well as overrunning Denmark at the same time, that they might be able to pull it off. Now, it's our contention that Hitler basically won the battle for Norway when the invasion succeeded. And my friend Geir Haar, who's got the big two volumes I was talking about, he takes a different point of view. Now, he's a Norwegian. He feels that you know, they could have managed to do something. But if you look on the first map, the Norwegians had 6 divisions. But the division is really a administrative unit, okay? Basically what they had is each of those divisions could field roughly a 5,000-man reinforced regiment, would you like to call it, like a regimental combat team. They usually had a third of the artillery of any other European division. Of course, it was all ancient. They had no sergeants. They eliminated the position of sergeant in the Norwegian military. They had, in the early 30s, because of the Depression, and because there was a labor government that was in power throughout the 30s, for the majority of it, they had gutted the officer corps to boot.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So.
No non-coms and not many officers.
Yep. And not enough training. But frankly, they didn't expect to be invaded. I mean, what's off their coast? It's the British Navy, even with some French ships. And the intelligence failures in this thing, I would say probably about a fifth of our book is just devoted to intelligence and how things were missed. It was by all sides, including the Germans. So, for example, the Germans were, and the British both knew for a fact that there were coast defense batteries at Narvik. Well, guess what? There weren't. You would have thought they would have figured that out, but they missed it. And, of course, the classic sinking of the German heavy cruiser Blücher in Oslo Fjord by the torpedoes that were based on land. Well, Abwehr, the military intelligence for the Germans, had found it, and they knew it was there. But it got lost in the bureaucracy. And when the Navy sailed up Oslo Fjord, they didn't know those torpedo batteries were there. So you've got some kind of some interesting things that are going on. There was one British admiral who was convinced by the end of March that the Germans were going to invade. And if you think about it, too, you've got literally dozens and dozens of transports heading north. Well, what do they pass through? They have to pass right through the Swedish-Danish corridor into the North Sea. And they actually even saw on the, a day before the invasion, German soldiers on these converted ferry boats or whatever they were using to be moved up north. But the message just doesn't get out. They don't get the word. And then you still had the guys in the Norway and in Denmark in their governments. They didn't want to believe that they were going to get invaded. And so, therefore, they didn't do anything. The mobilization orders for the Norwegian military basically went out on the night of the invasion. And you can guess what kind of chaos that resulted from that. They're also going to, they send it out by mail.
sounds like a
And by the way, assembly is 3 days from now. So, there's a fair number of stories where, say, like, let's say you're... command was the 3rd Division, but you're in the 2nd Division's territory at the time of the attack. Well, if you showed up at an arsenal to get weapons, you said, no. Literally, they tell them to get on the train and go to your the mobilization center. And this kind of thing occurred all through for the Norwegians.
Let's look at the submarines there.
And that's the second sheet. It doesn't quite show, but there was also 8 Allied submarines which were in transit going to the Norwegian coast. Max Horton, who was a World War I British hero, he operated in the Baltic just after the war with motor torpedo boats. He commanded the submarines, and he felt something was going down. And then, again, because of the early part of the war protocol, the British submarines were not allowed to torpedo merchant ships, period. And they could only go after warships, and they had to stay off certain distances from the Norwegian coast. Well, in the course of the 48 hours leading up to the invasion, that got changed. And, again, the day before the invasion, a transport with horses, with German troops, was torpedoed. The Kristiansand, which is down there in the south between Bergen and Oslo, they actually went out and they brought in 100 drowning victims that were saved, or their dead bodies. Of course, the horses were floating everywhere. And they asked, well, what are you doing? He says, well, our orders are to go to Bergen. This is a full day before the invasion. Now, the local commander, he had enough sense to at least put his own command on alert. But back at in Oslo, they're just like, no, this can't possibly be happening. And the thing is it is so hard to understand this. Belgium in World War I got devastated as a small country. Okay? It had a tremendous amount of damage done to the infrastructure. It suffered a lot of losses. So the Danish And the Norwegian mentality was, we do not want to be another Belgium. We want to avoid this. We'll do anything we can possibly do to avoid it. And what they did is, by not reacting, not defending their neutrality, especially in the case of Norway, they ended up getting overrun and occupied. Now, what we talk about in our book, and we contrast that with, is that in World War I, the Danes mobilized their military. They had 40, 45,000 troops from 1914 to 1918. In World War II, they mobilized 8,000 troops. And they started giving them leave to go home in the spring of 1940. Their batteries were literally still had grease in them, so they couldn't fire their coast defense batteries. I'm stuck here. In the case of the Danes, they had an interesting philosophy. They call it neo-neutralism. And this fellow, Munch, who was the foreign minister for the Danes, he had taken the government and been the foreign minister essentially through the 20s and 30s. And what he advocated was that if we get invaded by Germany or we get invaded by a Soviet Union, we're going to be dead anyway. So what I'm going to do is, instead of spending money on defense or trying to set up some sort of alliance system with Sweden or whatever, what we'll do is we'll pour all our money that we have into making our nation more coherent, more homogeneous, more interrelated. Well,
he promoted incest.
The kicker on this was that when the invasion took place, and the Danes fought for 3 hours, and the Danes surrendered after 3 hours, that he was in power for about another 4 months. What the Germans did when they took over Denmark is they basically left the Danish government in power. They said, we're just occupying you because, you know, we need to use your air bases. We need to be connected up with Norway. And it wasn't until August of 1943 that the Germans actually took over the Danish government. And it was largely due to a very simple fact, the fall of Mussolini. It was like then they knew that everything was starting to fall apart. And now here's an interesting little thing. Tom, my friend here, gave me this. This Taste of War is the best single book I've read on World War II in the last year. And it's all about food and both the major European powers as well as China and Japan and to a degree China, but primarily Japan. The Danes, it turns out, gave more food to the German Reich in 41, 42, 43 than occupied France or Ukraine. And basically, for a lot of regular staples, bacon, butter, dairy products, the Danes gave to Germany about 1 month's worth of food to the entire population of Germany. I mean, it's like we have to put some higher production factors now for Denmark on our Danes.
Okay.
I mean, who would have thought?
By the way, they actually rebred their hogs to suit the Danish taste in pork. Or to suit the German tanks during the war.
Huh.
Well, Jack, who's the author?
They were selling it to
them. People are trying to write this down.
Oh, this is
Taste of War.
Yeah, Taste of War. Lizzie Collingham. She's a Brit.
Collingham?
Yeah.
No, I meant to spell it. People trying to write it down.
It's Collingham.
The Taste of
War. What's the first name?
Lizzie. Lizzie.
Lizzie.
L-I-Z-Z-I-E. And I think she's Cambridge. Okay, let's talk about the Swedes. Battle of the Swedes in this. The Swedes, by the way, in August of 1943, they called up, I don't know if it was the Americans or the Brits, and says, What can we do to help you now? August 1943 is a real...
Now that we see which way the facts are falling.
Exactly. Exactly.
What can you do to keep the Russians from dragging us all to Siberia?
whose side are we going to be neutral on?
Exactly. So the invasion takes place on April 9th. On April 8th, the Swedish intelligence had firm knowledge that Sweden was not going to be invaded and the invasion was going to be in Denmark and Norway. And they didn't tell anybody.
Well, that's normal. They would have been saying,
yeah, that's a good thing. And they practiced a silent mobilization immediately after the invasion so that they have a tremendous number of people up there. So I remember my point about the Danes. So the Danes in World War I, they had 40,000 mobilized. They had 8,000 in World War II. The one we always like to compare it to is Switzerland. Switzerland mobilized their army in both wars, and they were not invaded. And I'm convinced that if the Danes and the Norwegians had really mobilized their forces at the beginning of 1939, that neither of the countries would have been invaded. In one of our chapters, we ended, it was deterrence that failed. And it was deterrence that failed because they wouldn't protect deterrence.
Well, I tend to doubt anything could have saved the Danes and Norwegians. You're quite correct.
But the point is it would have come with a cost. And the German military did not want to do it. See, one of the things that's also interesting about this whole thing is that it's argued that Mussolini decided that he was a warlord when he conquered Ethiopia. My God, I'm a good general. I'm going to be just like Scipio Africanus or whatever. Well, with Hitler, when he first approached the general staff with the idea of going in to protect Norway or taking over Norway, they said, we don't want anything to do with this. You know, I mean, we're going to be at sea, we're going to be dealing with the Royal Navy, we're going to lose a bunch of our soldiers, and that's the last thing we want. And the German army had also, in World War I, been approached to taking over at least Denmark. And the German Navy really wanted that, because they could then have extended their bases, they would have gotten out of that little pocket of the North Sea. And actually, in World War I, in the interwar period, before and after Hitler comes to power, and then at the beginning of the war, the German Navy is one of the main driving forces to invade Norway. And that, I think, we've got pretty well documented.
Actually, all they would have had to do is get all the Schleswig-Holstein back and use the canal. It's a risk, but it was a way out.
Right.
They had the canal
in World War II. In 1939, they never lost the Kiel Canal.
The thing is that they wanted the bases, and they wanted to operate out there. There's a guy, Wegner is his name, and he has what pretty much discusses the German need to have bases outside of the North Sea. And in his ideal world, it would be French ports like Bordeaux, France.
Exactly. Or Saint-Nazaire.
Well, as it turned out, he did get his wish. Yeah. You know, he got the Norwegian one first. So,
but would they have gone to Norway to get the heavy hydrogen, heavy water? You mean the heavy water that they needed?
But that wasn't the motivation in 1940. Yeah. This was all over iron ore. And one of the points that we try to make is that this is a resource war, and that the resource in this case is Swedish iron ore. It's some of the purest stuff there is. And the problem is the Baltic freezes. So in the summer, it's not a problem for the Swedes to ship it to their ports and ship it down from the Baltic. And they had a quota, and some of it went to Britain. And, you know, all that kind of stuff had been diplomatically worked out. But in the winter, they have to rail it. And it's apparently it's the most northerly railroad system on the planet, from the ore fields in the north end of Sweden to Narvik. And that's where the importance of Narvik comes in. So
it was the Gulf Stream. Narvik was an ice free port because of the Gulf Stream, and so the ore carrying ships could sail from Narvik down to Hamburg.
Well, the other thing was that because of all those islands, I mean, shoot, there's something like 1,500 islands along that Norwegian coast, and some of them are, you know, the size of a pitcher of water, probably just to kind of bottle the water. But The point is it's a sheltered passage. And by having ships going down through there, guess what? They're in neutral waters. The British can't come in and sink the merchant ships carrying the iron ore to Germany. And Germany, at the beginning, now remember, they haven't conquered France at this point, so they don't have the iron fields of Lorraine. They see that they need as much iron ore as they can get. And the Swedish total export probably represents a quarter to a third of the iron ore that they were getting at the beginning of the war.
I mean, the thing is that the Swedish iron ore was pure enough, so it was so pure, it meant a lot less German resources were necessary to refine it. And it also meant that just in terms of all overall German manufacturing, they had that kind of mix of iron, technical types of iron, already hardwired into their economy. And so having to ship to a different quality of iron ore would have thrown a whole lot of things off of the German economy. It was just
that would have been an ease of smelting, not an ease of
Ease of smelting, yeah. But anyway, it was just
two very, very different processes. Yeah, okay.
So the point being they're already dependent on that.
Yeah.
Right. And they don't want to lose this resource, and that's what they're looking at. And they toyed with the idea of invading Sweden, but the Swedes had already come to him and said, look, these ore fields you want are way, way far in the north. They're not just over the border, and we've already wired them to blow them up if you guys do this. So, and then, of course, after the invasion, the Swedish military just springs up everywhere. They ended up fielding, I think it's 320,000 men, which is it's a pretty good deterrent. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about Swedes. Oh, these guys are real sweet. So if you look at your map and you see Narvik in the far north, it's ages away. You're out of luck.
Here, Jack, you're mine. I've got Narvik.
Thanks.
So Narvik is way, way isolated in the far north, and that was the longest shot that the Germans had taken. And actually, at the very end of the fighting in June of 1940, they would be forced out of Narvik by the Allies. And it's actually, we claim that it's the first Allied victory against the German Wehrmacht. But there was a couple submarines that were in there that were sunk, that were German U-boats. And they had these crews, and they had to get them back to Germany, because it doesn't do any good to have these U-boat crews up in Narvik without a submarine. So Swedes let them use their border and the Red Cross. And they had a couple of convoys going on by land, along in Sweden, and then going into Narvik, and the other way around. The ones going north smuggled ammunition. They smuggled radio equipment. They smuggled radio operators, other specialized types. And then on vice versa, they brought out a couple of prisoners that the Germans had. They captured Winston Churchill's nephew, I think it was. He was a news reporter. I think that's his only claim to fame. But they also brought out some of the wounded, and they also brought out, these were all clear violations of the Geneva Conference and all that. But the Swedes basically rolled over.
They did it on the other side too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You know how we were getting Allied air crews out of Sweden back to Britain?
Yeah, are we talking like 43?
Yeah, pretty much throughout.
Yeah.
They were flying them out, and the Germans could never figure out what the airline schedule was. You know why? They only flew when the weather was too bad to fly. They were using DC-3s. Which, of course, will fly no matter what you do.
Early on, before the actual invasion took place, and we discussed it in the book, the Russo-Finnish War is going on. And the Finnish War was used by the British and the French as an excuse so that they could bring a bunch of troops ashore at Narvik and seize the Swedish oil fields, or ore fields, I should say. And, they helped out Finland as well. And there was a whole movement of getting to that. And that's one of the reasons why Hitler got wind of this. And that was one of the reasons.
Oh, is that mentioned in your book?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. 105 days the Finns held off the Russians. Boy, it was an embarrassing to the Russians.
Yeah, no, it was.
So 105 days and 5,000 casualties.
Soviets.
So, fair enough.
Most of them are Russian.
So, at one point, Ironside, who was the head of the British Army at the time, was told, we could fly out some paratroopers. Oh, we have paratroopers in Britain right now, but we could send some planes and fly to Helsinki. And he said, we have the capability right now of flying 40 soldiers to Helsinki. This is in the late 1939, early 1940. So, it was really interesting when he made the previous speaker, when he made the analogy between doing the waltz versus the jitterbug. It's really applicable to this whole situation. I mean, the British are just constantly surprised by what the Germans could do and how quick they could do it. Some other interesting thing that's came up. The Norwegians had one tank. They called it the nation's tank or the king's tank. It was a Swedish body of 1935 technology. And they literally took it around and put it in all the cities. And it was just the show. And they called it the nation's tank, one tank. They didn't have any anti-tank guns. The Danes, at least, had bought anti-tank guns. But the Norwegians had ordered. They ordered 37 millimeter anti-tank guns, and they were due to be delivered in April from Germany. They did have 20 millimeters that they were just building, but essentially what they ended up having to do for the tanks when they were Molotov cocktails, of course, that was used by the Norwegians. But they ended up taking some of their trucks and mounting the 75 millimeter field gun on the back, and that was one way to try to stop the tank. The Germans really fine-tuned this too. They only sent Panzer 1s and 2s, no Panzer 3s. And why? Well, because they're light. Mm-hmm. And it was easy to get them off the ships, because that's the way they had to bring them in. With one exception, they had five tanks, Mark 6s, which had that actually kind of remind me of...
Six?
Mm-hmm, yeah. It was a failed design from the 30s. It had a 75 millimeter turret, and then it had a 37 millimeter side sponson, kind of like a Grant. Very thin armor, which is one of the failing points. The things, there's a picture in the book, they're giant. Well, what they did is they sent three of them over because of the five that they had. The other two did not have armor, they had just steel. So there was actually plating on these three, and they paraded them right down through downtown Oslo. And like, everybody see these giant tanks? And I mean, these five-man crew or something. One of them later got knocked out, so they sent one of the steel ones to replace it. But they survived the war, best of my knowledge. The whole thing about the Norwegians is, in some ways, I spent 10 years working on this thing, four rewrites. I mean, Alexander was a co-author, and he certainly helped, but the majority of the work was on my end. And we were really fortunate in getting a couple of really good sources. And so far, the reviews have been very nice. So, questions?
How many trips did you take to Norway, though?
Pardon?
How many trips did you take to Norway?
Just one. We went into 2005, met Alessandro. Well, I went to Copenhagen, traveled up to the north end of Denmark, took the ferry from the north end of Denmark, right up Oslo Fjord, which was a treat. So that was exactly where the Germans, what they had to deal with.
Have you ever read Peter Freuchen's Rotten Viking, or something Viking, Zoroastrian? And he describes his experiences. He owned a small island off the Danish coast, and he was using it as a ferry point for people escaping Germany from the war. Mm. And it eventually got him caught, and he escaped. And he got caught again, and around the end of the war, he realized that nobody was actually guarding the prison camp, and the barbed wire was all on the ground, so he just kind of walked out. And nobody said boo.
Yeah, well, we were totally focused on just 1940. I mean, we discuss other things in there, especially post-war.
Well, you mentioned the 1943 takeover. Mm-hmm. And, of course, earlier the Germans actually allowed the Danes to hold elections.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely.
Boy, was that embarrassing.
So, Jack.
Let me finish up with Dana's point. I then met Alexandra, who came up And my friend Andrew Smith, who's helped me out with stuff since I was a teenager, he's a British fellow. And the three of us traveled down to Bergen. Alexander went home, we got up to Trondheim, and then I drove, which is the only time I've ever driven in a foreign country, believe it or not, not counting Canada or Mexico, from Trondheim down to Oslo. And that was a real treat. But it really gave us, and we made, I went in March and April, so I could get a sense of what it was like at the same time of year.
I'm currently trying to get through a book on Norway, not yours, unfortunately. This particular author is spending an awful lot of time on the storm that happened to hit at the same time, the invasion.
Oh, yeah.
Did that have, it's like they're feeling that the storm had an enormous impact on both sides and why there were so many failures. I mean, it explains, they attribute much of the British fleet lack of support to that.
No.
Just wondering how true that was.
The problem with the Brits was that they thought that the Germans were sending a raiding ship into the Atlantic. So, in fact, any of you ever played my game Norway 1940, there's two different victory conditions, and only the German player knows what the victory conditions are, which is you either invade Norway or you exit a raiding ship into the North Atlantic. And so it creates the fog of war, the same situation that the British commander had.
Which they were deathly afraid of.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the biggest thing. Well, who's going to invade Norway? My gosh. I mean, you know, the British Navy stands right in the way. I mean, there's no question that the British Navy, you know, heavily outnumbered the Germans. As far as the storm, the poor mountain troops going to Narvik were seasick as anything, but it kind of gets sheltered, again, because of all the islands off the coast, as they're approaching Narvik, so some of them had a reasonable chance of recovering from, you know, yeah, I mean, a lot of these, plus these were Austrian mountaineers, so they probably never even been on the ocean before.
Yeah, you got a question over here.
How many Danish sources were you able to use at the National Archives, or just very superficial, or secondary sources? Or?
There's a lot of diplomatic history stuff, okay, leading up to the war, and the bibliography is very complete in that regard.
Okay.
And it's very well footnoted. Actual fighting, there's for example, and we mentioned it in the very beginning, there's a fellow who has an internet site, Warren or something like that, but it's right in the forward of the book.
Okay.
And then there's a couple of books in Danish, and I mean, I'd be a liar if I said I know Norwegian and Danish, but I did have to learn a few words, and it's really interesting, too. There's even to this day, and we ran into a couple of places, Norwegians who resent the Danes for not having fought longer. You know, there is...
And they both hate the Swedes.
And and here's another thing. The Swedish intelligence, one of the things that they get in April, but it was a few days before the invasion, several days before the invasion, they get this information. There's a German mountain division. It's training. It's training in northern Germany. There are no mountains in northern Germany. And that was another key. And if you look at what a lot of the Japanese did early in the war, using mountain troops for invasion, is because of the light field packs, light artillery. I mean, everything is already very weight conscious. And so that's another reason it made sense to use mountain troops. Well, plus, Norway is obvious. There's a lot of mountains there, too. A couple things about the post-war. There were a fair number of Norwegian women who got pregnant from German soldiers. In the late 40s, the Norwegian government seriously proposed sending 8,000 of these children to Australia to get them out of the country. And actually, beginning of this century, the Norwegian government apologized to these children, who, of course, were older adults at this point, obviously.
Older than all of us.
Pardon?
Older than most of us.
Yeah,
I get most
of us. Yeah, that's true. The
Danes and the...
We didn't say the reason why they wanted to deport them.
I mean, but there's...
Collaboration prejudice.
Yeah.
No, they were severely prejudiced against the other Norwegians. Everybody understood that, I guess. Okay.
Yeah, for example, just recently, I forget if it's the NATO or it's this European army that they've been talking about for the last 15 years, but in about 2005, 2007, somewhere in there, a Norwegian battalion was teamed with a German battalion, and they had to take the Norwegian battalion, set it aside, and go through a special training program with them to sort of make them realize they had to work with the Germans. I mean, it's...
Look, you're not supposed to shoot the Germans. I'll
shoot first. The
Danes and the Norwegians prosecuted more people percentage-wise at the end of World War II than any other European nation for war crimes, collaboration, etc. I mean, just to give you one example, because Norway had their unemployment rate was just now starting to come down from the Great Depression when the invasion took place, but it was still about 18%. So, and the Norwegians are a lot poorer. Then the Germans are almost like a rich uncle coming into town. You don't like your uncle in this case. But the second day at the invasion of Trondheim, there's an airfield about 30 miles outside, and they wanted to get it repaired. They hired local Norwegians to repair the airfield so the German planes could start landing and bringing in battalion after battalion, as well as supplies. And it was not uncommon. So a lot of the wartime collaboration stuff came back to light some people at the end of the war. And of course, Quisling was executed, and there were some other...
And his relatives are still trying to get him
exonerated.
Yeah.
There's no way you can exonerate that, man.
No. I said they were going to succeed. I said they're trying. I mean, there was also the PR foo that the Germans pulled in Denmark. Okay, after World War I, when Germany's economy was just flat, and the Danes fostered a large number of young Germans.
So did the Norwegians.
They took them in, fed them, clothed them, they had them educated.
Yeah.
Guess who the Wehrmacht went through the forces and picked for the initial occupation troops, and whose Danes' reaction was, we took care of you as kids, you come back and you pay us this way. Say, what? Fairly surely they all got pulled out and replaced.
You think they would treat the Danes pretty well? I mean,
they tried to. They're Nordic brothers.
Yeah, they sent them in parties. They spoke Danish.
Well, Rader actually, when he resigned in, I believe, 1943, as the head of the German Navy, one of the reasons he said for his resignation was because he was so disappointed that the Norwegians and the Danes hadn't embraced the German brothers. And of course, Rader was a big advocate of the invasion. So there's they call it the poster. And at the airfields right after the war, they have the poster, and then you'd go up and you'd see it. And what it was basically, if anybody who's not Norwegian starts to land at one of our airfields, you are authorized to shoot at them. You do not have to call Oslo and find out if it was okay. And they also decided that it would probably be a good idea to have a couple of tanks near the airfields in the future, 45, 46, 47. And the ones that were first deployed were Panzer III's. So the whole thing, it's just fascinating to see how the Norwegians asked after this, why did this happen, the Danes as well, and both those countries were one of the first two countries to join NATO, and it's largely because of April 9th, 1940.
Mm-hmm. The Danes also refused to get all the Schleswig-Holstein back.
Oh.
They'd solved it in 1920, and they didn't want to reopen that camp. It took them 1,000 years to settle the damn thing.
Yeah, what?
Schleswig-Holstein.
There's two. Denmark had lost so many wars in the 1800s. The border was almost to the tip of Jutland.
They went back
because they kept losing the plebiscites.
Basically,
because the people knew that they'd have a better life in Germany than in Denmark.
No, basically, you go back. It was one Danish king who said, after they acquired Holstein, which is the southern part, said the future of Schleswig and Holstein is forever linked. And so every time Denmark was on the winning side of a war, they got Schleswig-Holstein. Every time Germany was on the winning side, they got Schleswig-Holstein. This continued for literally hundreds of years. Finally, after World War I, the Danes said, hey, dual linguistic survey. Where do people speak German? Where do they speak Danish? Hold a plebiscite. Do you want to be German? Do you want to be Danish? They found that the linguistic line and the vote went about the same way, and it was halfway up Schleswig. So they said, wham, there's the border. Southern half, German. Northern part, which was less, Danish, which actually put the southern Danish border about, what, 60 kilometers north, or 100 kilometers north of where it had been 1,000 years ago.
Originally, it bordered on Hamburg and Lübeck. Yeah. That's where the border was
After World War II, the Allies looked at the Danes and said, you're part of the winning side. Would you like Schleswig-Holstein back? The Danes said, God, no, we settled it in 1920. Put it back in the 1920 line. And that's where it is now.
I have some more games that question, Jeff. This is what happened on mega exploitation and whatnot for strategic World War II games. Now, the Germans get building squad on Norway, this side geography.
Well, they do get iron ore.
That was Swedish iron ore, not Norwegian iron ore.
Well, there's also a fair amount of fish.
Fish, okay.
That's whale oil.
Right. Because in terms of this, just as Jeff just quoted, in terms of dairy and pork, the U.S. supplied about the Russians with about 3 pounds, I think, was it a day or a week? Could be indifferent.
Oh, the Soviet Union's. I can't believe they fought as well as they did, and they weren't even fed.
They've got an enormous amount of the Soviet food for the Soviet Army in World War II. Came from American sources, but in terms of, it sounds like, when you just said about dairy and poultry for the entire Reich, as opposed to the
for one month. Army.
Then we're looking at the Danes being a source of raw calories for and essential oils for the Germans. It was a rather significant part of their. And if you read the Lizzie Cunningham, realized the Germans were still starving large parts of Europe to feed themselves. And that was part of their.
We don't want another turnip winter. Yeah.
And this is also where, and so this is something to keep up in Morgan and Jack on your friend in the time of his last name,
Alessandro.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The Germans got more economic value out of northern Italy than anywhere else in Europe. I believe something like they got war production about 40%, equal about 40% of Germany's from northern Italy, because it was voluntarily economically integrated Germany under Mussolini. That's something you guys keep an eye on. Is the our country's pre-war GDP had nothing to do with its values of the Reich. What the value of the Reich comes from integration, not from raw GDP. Denmark and Northern Italy were very well integrated. Likewise, for the Allies got France back. They got basically very little French economic output. And so I'm just saying this in terms of these games.
That's why Denmark has to be changed. Not all war game maps.
They all have to be changed.
Zero military power. 500 points of logistics.
Yeah. You're talking about stripping food resources and that. 30 years ago, I worked with a fellow who, he got drafted and spent 6 months doing occupation duty in France. And he said he was astonished because
as a German,
okay. And who else? who else did I do that? No, he was not occupied.
I guess
they were friends, supposedly. At least when the Gauls showed up. But he said he was astonished because things like silk stockings and eggs were easy to get in France. They could buy them and send them home. He then got released, went back to his job, declared was essential. Which was driving a delivery truck for local grocery stores, like right out of high school. And then late in the war, he got drafted into the Volkssturm and was in Breslau.
Yeah, he survived that, by the way.
Yeah.
Getting back to Norway, I've actually read your book, and you made some interesting points, and I wanted to ask you a couple things about what you felt were things that were surprises to you while you were doing this research, because you, like you said, you had your Norway 1940 game, which I actually worked on with you.
Yeah, you did the math then.
Okay, so between way back, what was that, the 80s, late 70s or something? Right?
Early 80s.
Yeah, so I
think it came out in 82.
So what we understood, or what we thought we understood about Norway and the war and the 1940 campaign and so forth, and what you feel you've learned now, all these years later, because you have a different perspective. You're obviously more mature about things, and you also look at things differently than we looked at it back then as younger men. What things do you feel are in this book that are truly different, or that were surprises that you discovered?
Well, the game, I mean, from 82, in a lot of ways, somewhat superficially, even from a naval game designer standpoint. For example, the Norwegians had, I can't remember the exact number, it's less than a dozen, but I think it's about 10 submarines. Well, they didn't do any maintenance on them. So when the war came, instead of having this deterrent of these submarines, which would have been, a vital deterrent, they could only dive to 50 meters. One of them started smoking so bad inside it had to surface and surrender. That was down in Oslo. A couple of them managed to get to England, where they're turned into training submarines. I mean, if you're going to have a deterrent, you damn well better find
it. It better work.
Yeah, exactly.
But what did they think? I thought the Norwegians were betting on neutrality.
Well, they were.
That they were a huge merchant marine, transporting goods for everybody, and that's how they earned their money.
Well, they signed a big agreement with the Germans. And of course, both the Danish and the Norwegians had suffered merchant ship losses from the first 6 months of the war, 8 months of the war.
In other words,
so was it your research that the Norwegian government still felt that this neutrality was going to protect them?
Right. Well, they were just in a complete state of denial. I mean, to me, the contrast between what the Swiss did in World War II and what the Norwegians and the Danes did is just striking.
But didn't the Swiss learn from the Norwegian example?
Swiss mobilized in September 19th, August 1939.
I think the Swiss learned from the Dukes of Burgundy.
Yeah.
In other words, the way to be neutral is to be such a son of a bitch that nobody will bother you. It's just not worth the money to go after you.
And whereas the Norwegians were locked into this thing, and it wasn't just limited to the Norwegians. I think it also applicable to why the Belgians surrendered in World War II as quickly as they did. They didn't want to see what happened to Belgium in World War I happen to them. But the approach they took to keep that from happening is essentially invited invasion. And the classic example is the Altmark affair. Does everyone know what the Altmark affair is? Okay,
yes.
The Altmark was a German special supply ship. It was actually had naval officers on it. There's I think five of them were built. And the Altmark had 301 British prisoners because they'd been out for the Graf von Spee, out there in the Atlantic, and was on its way home. And I can't remember, February or March, I think, of 40. The Altmark is working its way down through those islands that we were talking about off the Norwegian coast, staying in the neutral area. But it's a ship of war. It actually carries 5.9-inch guns, I think torpedoes.
Open later set up as a Q ship.
It's hidden.
A Q ship.
It's hidden. Well, yeah. It's a supply ship primarily. It's big. I mean, the thing is big. It's 20,000 tons or something. The other thing that's interesting, you can't find it in any naval annual in 1939. I mean, the Germans did this on the slot.
The ones where they had a lot of fake IDs to go with it?
That too. And, change the stack, change the name.
Change
anyway.
So what,
The as it was coming down, this is where Churchill, who's now back at the Admiralty, sends in Captain Vion, who would later become Admiral Vion, And they stormed the ship in Norwegian waters with a couple of Norwegian gunboats, for want of a better word, that were kind of escorting it and trying to keep the British and the Germans apart. And a Norwegian captain afterwards said, you know, if that torpedo boat, our Norwegian torpedo boat, and it was, you know, built in 1901, and it was, you know, 70 tons or something, it was much, much, much smaller than the British destroyers. If we fired one gun at the British for violating our neutrality, we probably wouldn't have been invaded. And that captain was actually killed on the first day of the fighting. But he was probably correct. All they needed to do was show that they were going to defend their neutrality, because after that event, Hitler, who was disgusted, first of all, that there was no British killed, and there were seven or eight Germans who were killed, and that this thing even had occurred, and that was one of the final triggers saying, you know what, Norwegians aren't going to defend themselves, we're going to have to take them over. And that was another.
Right, the Norwegians aren't going to defend themselves. The British can walk in and take them over. If they can be walked in and taken over, better us than the British.
Yep. So, any other questions?
Yeah. How many more of those do you have? Just those three?
No, I have some more.
Okay. I just want to see if it's available online, that's all.
Yeah, it is. Casemate is handling it. I know they're out for another 2 weeks. They sold out with.
No, I just want to know if it's available for my Kindle. That's
yeah, that I don't know. You'll have to check.
It's not there.
So how much?
$25.
Welcome to the connected world.
And Jack will sign it and will not lower the value of the book.
What was the fellow who had?
Yeah, he said that he had a game. He had games, and he was upset because back in the 70s, Jim Dunning had offered to sign a copy of War in Europe or something, right? And he was outraged. I was like, I can't get as much of you right on this, you know, because you're ruining the game. And of course, now, because of that Jim Dunning's name on it, you know, you probably add $25.
Well, you know, I have a copy of the AD&D Dungeon Master's Guide, some of Gary Gygax, and I helped write it.
Yeah.
How much is it worth with Gygax to scooch your mind in?
Well, Gygax is, since he's dead, is even worth more.
That's worth more. Yeah.
I think Isaac Asimov had a reputation of sign anything. Mm-hmm. You shove a piece of paper in his autograph. So people's favorite trick was shove a blank check in front of it, which he would sign something. I think he was, I don't remember who he used. I think it was Norman Spinrad or somebody else. That was the name he would sign to it.
So I'm going to give a talk on Monday on Avalon Hill. I just got back from the WBC, where we had a reunion of Avalon Hill employees. I worked briefly at Avalon Hill 75, 76.
But it's World Board Game Championships.
Right.
It's Worldwide Wrestling Federation.
Right, and it's basically people who love to play board games, obviously.
So you don't feel the joke is back when I went with the British and invading Norway?
Say what now?
You don't pull a joke of back when I went with the British to invade Norway?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, you're talking about having worked for Avalon Hill in 1976. You know, you're going to claim to have been there in World War II.
Yeah, no. But it was a really interesting reunion. Craig Taylor died, who did Wooden Ships and Iron Men and Air Force and my flat top. And he worked originally Battle Line. I spent a summer with him down at Battle Line, and then he went to Avalon Hill, was there for a fairly long stint. But anyways, the first time we've ever had a reunion of employees, and there was about 13 of us. It was Don Greenwood ran it. If you're around on, and if that interests you, wargaming history, I've got some interesting quotes that grew out of the 6 or 7 hours that we spent on Friday, August 2nd, reliving the old days and taking questions and answers from a full hall.
Mm-hmm. And so, tomorrow you've got a talk on World War I battleships.
Yep.
Reassessment.
Yeah, all every game that's ever been done on World War I battleships, you can just throw in the incinerator, including my own fleet admiral. They're worthless.
And how many of the British ones will blow up from flashback?
Well,
So the Avalon Hill talk, do you get into the Dot era or before that?
This was basically, we were the Dot era. I mean, Charles Roberts' name came up, obviously, but, Charles Roberts died last year.
Mm-hmm.
And
3CI, the GMT magazine, they did a nice...
the one that's... I got a couple of them sitting right there.
Yep.
3CI.
I think there, one of those has the... the
could be, yeah.
The tribute to Charles Rivers?
I think so.
But, so anyway, that had... Yeah, that's that is that issue. I'm pretty sure. And there was a lot of dot stories. I mean, the fact that you had a printer running a game company is not a bad idea, but it turned out that none of the dots, none of the upper management played games, and they had no idea what they had. And that's one thing that's, I think, fundamentally changed, like GMT, for example. I mean, they're game players. You know, I mean,
so it's fantasy flight games.
Yeah.
They're gamers. So
yeah, exactly.
Right. It's not like a
business. Yeah, on one hand.
Right.
You know, I mean, you guys are obviously gamers. So,
that's typical of most small companies. I have a story that I'll throw in on Monday, but a lot of people won't be here. So, the Dots, they're talking about Eric and Jack Dot. Eric was the father, Jack was the son. Dots, D-O-T-T, and they were the printing company for Avalon Hill. When Charles Roberts failed with his business and couldn't produce games anymore, the printer was owed a lot of money, and so they took over Avalon Hill. And then they continued it, and they made it more successful because being printers, they didn't have to have the markup. They were able to get the maximum profit squeezed out of everything. My story about the Dots is that I was telling some younger people who didn't know what I was talking about. So they probably always know. So I was just talking to them about Avalon Hill and the Dots who ran it, okay? And they kept up, and they looked stunned. And I kept on going on about, you know, those Dots, you know, this and those Dots, that. And as they were stunned because they were, you know, a young liberal couple, and they thought I was basically using the N-word for Indians. You know, Dots?
Oh, really?
Okay,
they
thought I was calling Indians Dots, you know, as a yes.
As a derogatory.
Right, I'm looking at them like, and they're looking at me like, oh my god, Dave's a racist. Stop.
At least you call them the feathers.
Yeah, right. Oh yeah. Anyway, so that's my thought. So I'll repeat that on Monday because it's just so hilarious.
The best quote was one of the designers said that Jack Dot late in the course of the Avalon Hills said, really smart people don't like to read.
Yes, that's why they're really smart. They don't read.
It's like
that dot one is like the time the Dutch RAF pilot was being taken around to little old ladies' clubs to raise morale with an RAF liaison officer's English to go along to make sure he didn't step on any toes the wrong way because, you know, he was Dutch. And the story goes that he was standing in front of these little old ladies' garden club saying, you know, there I was, and the fucker did this. And eventually the officer stops and says, excuse me, ladies, let me explain that Fokker is an aircraft manufacturer. And the Dutchman says, yeah, that's right. Only this fucker, he was flying a Messerschmitt.
Yes. Jack, thank you so much.